On this week's program, a conversation with Ted Libby. He's the author of the NPR Encyclopedia of Classical Music. His book has broken new ground in publishing by having a companion website where readers can listen to full-length examples of musical works cross-referenced in the book. Tom DiNardo explains how he spent 16 years trying to organize a performance of a work for organ by legendary Hollywood composer David Raxon. A song, After Sundown, will be performed at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Sunday. In our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, Susan Lewis explores Betsy Ross House, and Jason Pfeiffer previews the world premiere of Some Men, a Terrence McNally play set to open at the Philadelphia Theatre Company. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Broadcaster and writer Ted Libby is best known as the curator of the basic record collection on NPR's classical music magazine show Performance Today. In the early 80s, he was a music critic for the New York Times. He later served as editor of High Fidelity and Musical America magazines. And in 2000, he became classical editor of the monthly Schwann Inside. He's also been a consultant to the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Carnegie Hall. Ted Libby is the author of five books, including the NPR Guide to Building a Classical CD Collection and the Official History of the National Symphony Orchestra. These days, when not writing them himself, he reviews books for the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. His latest work, the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music, gives readers a link to a website constructed by the Naxos record label, where readers can log in and listen to works cited by Libby in his book. This is not your typical website with low-resolution 30-second or 1-minute clips of music. No, the Libby page, or should I say pages, contains full works, some as long as 30 minutes. Ted Libby was in Philadelphia earlier this week and came by our studios to talk about the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music. I first asked him who the book was written for.
I was writing for the listener. So I was writing for people who listen to music on the radio, or to compact discs or their iPods, but people who enjoy listening and want to learn more and to have some doors open to things that might be interested. So for a curious listener, someone who's really enthusiastic about music and may be interested in learning more about it.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to have an oral companion to this? And then how did you negotiate with Naxos that it wouldn't be 30 or 60-second clips?
It was much easier than you make it sound, because it was Naxos that actually proposed this to us when they found out that we were doing the book. Klaus Heyman is someone that I've known for many, many years. And when he found out I was doing this book, it was just at an encounter at a radio conference a few years ago. He said, "We'll do a website." And we started talking about it right then and there. And when we said website, of course, I thought maybe we're talking about this little snippets that would perhaps give people some idea, but not very good idea. No, no, no. Whole tracks, which in the case of Naxos means whole pieces.
Wow.
In many cases, or at least entire movements. So we have 527 links currently that stream easily, even on dial-up. It's really amazing. And some of them are 30 minutes long. The entire picture is at an exhibition, 33 minutes. The entire Liszt B minor sonata, 31 minutes. You have movements of Bruckner symphonies, movements of Beethoven symphonies and Brahms and concertos and all the rest of this. It's between 75 and 100 hours of music from the entire breadth of the repertory, from early music, medieval music, all the way up to John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine.
This is really, I mean, Naxos and yourself have really stepped out on a limb here, because I think most of the recording industry is very, very afraid of the idea that if people can hear this stuff for free online on their computer, there's really no incentive for them to go out and buy a CD. What's been the thinking with Naxos? If I can go and hear Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition, why am I going to buy a Naxos CD to hear exactly the same thing?
I think you might then be tempted to buy a Naxos CD of some other piece by Mussorgsky or some other Russian music. The idea here is you open the door wide enough, and it doesn't mean that people stand out on the sidewalk and look in because the view's great. They're going to walk in, and they're going to roam around, and they're going to look for things. The platforms are changing. The sales of compact discs are no longer going up. But there is certainly still a demand for music, and I think the whole industry is looking around right now and trying to decide, okay, where is this going to come? Where is it going to fall out? Is it going to be digital downloads? Is it going to be some other hard disk of some kind. And until that's decided, it's hard to sort of judge what the trends are. But I think that there will always be a demand. I think that the doing this is not going to discourage that in the least. In fact, when you go onto the site, as you have done, isn't there a temptation once you're there to sort of say, oh,
just click around. Yeah, just find around. Other stuff. And randomly, I haven't heard that in a while, or remind yourself. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You having this tool at your disposal to send the reader to the website to actually encounter the music, did that change your writing style?
It didn't change the writing very much at all. I can explain how that happened. The book was mostly written by the time Klaus and I spoke about this. What we did do, though, was we knew that we would have up to 600 links and that they would be generous. Then it became a matter of choosing. You want to get the maximum use out of a particular link. So if you can use a link to illustrate three or four different things, then that's one to go for. So for the English horn, for instance, mm-hmm. I chose the Largo of Dvorak's New World Symphony. That also gave me a link that I could use in the entry for the piece itself, the New World Symphony, and in the entry for Dvorak. So I got three uses out of that one. That was the kind of thinking we did to select these links very carefully so we get a broad span of music, music from different periods, music of different genres. Then I added text, a sentence here, a sentence there, many, many times. So the result is that people are not just reading through something and they see a little icon that tells them there's a link. We'll tell them something about
what
they're going to hear. So that's what's happened. And so there was a little bit of change in the content, but not in the style.
This is a big brick of a book.
Yeah.
How do I start?
Well, it looks big and daunting, and yet you start by doing just what you have done now. And for the benefit of the listeners, you just opened it to any page.
Mm-hmm.
You just let it fall open. At that point, the workman design takes over, and you see a page that has very interesting illustrations on it, photographs, and you see that there's sidebar material as well that directs readers to recommended recordings, and these are not solely or even primarily Naxos recordings.
Mm-hmm.
These are recommended recordings from the entire catalog of classical recordings, everything that is out there or has been out there. So you open it to any page and you see already visually interesting items. And then it's just a matter of jumping in. There are a lot of cross-references in the book, so that already there are pathways that are created by this book to assist the reader in learning more about a particular idea, a genre, a topic, a period in music, or a particular composer. You can read through it and decide if there's new information there that's interesting, and you can explore further in the book.
Ted Libby, author of the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music, which is out now in paperback on the Workman imprint.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
For 16 years, Philadelphia Daily News arts writer Tom DiNardo has been trying to arrange a performance of his friend David Raxon's A Song After Sundown, a work for organ and orchestra. Now the launch of a new Kimmel Center organ presents the perfect opportunity. Here's his story.
David Raxon was born in Philadelphia, where his father conducted music to silent films and subbed as a lower reed player with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Raxon paid for his tuition at the University of Pennsylvania by playing clarinet in a dance band and writing arrangements. After graduation, one of his charts to I Got Rhythm was heard by pianist Oscar Levant, who showed it to George Gershwin. That connection opened the door to scoring Broadway shows, until the call came from Hollywood. By his mid-20s, the ambitious Raxon was scoring the film Modern Times for Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin fired Raxon five times, then rehired him each time when the brash kid's instincts proved right. Raxon studied with Arnold Schoenberg, orchestrated circus polka for no less than Igor Stravinsky, and received a performance of his piece Montage by Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra. After scoring a long list of what he called gru and horror flicks, he finally became famous instantly with his score to the 1944 film Laura. With Johnny Mercer lyrics added a year later, Laura remains one of the most recorded songs in history. Raxon's theme from the 1951 film The Bad and the Beautiful is a Hollywood legend, and his music for The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, Force of Evil, and the original Carrie remain classics. Forever Amber and Separate Tables brought Raxon Oscar nominations, and he also composed hundreds of television shows and three musicals. Raxon and I met in Hollywood almost 30 years ago and became friends during the many conferences he headed of the Society for the Preservation of Film Music. In 1984, Raxon wrote A Song After Sundown as a commission for the American Guild of Organists Conference in San Francisco, with Wanamaker organist Keith Chapman as soloist. After Chapman died in a 1989 plane crash, his music was willed to conductor Mark Mostovoy, who gave me the orchestral score to A Song After Sundown as a keepsake. Raxon had written on the manuscript, in his typically colorful prose, "I think of this piece as a blues meditation for people who falter after twilight." When Raxon returned to Philadelphia, his first visit in 40 years in 2000, I showed him his original conductor's score of A Song After Sundown. He told me that the music for the individual orchestral players had been lost after the San Francisco performance, and he gave me the piece's full history. The theme was originally composed for a 1961 film called Too Late Blues, in which a jazz septet playing the theme was drowned out by John Cassavetes' dialogue. And years after the organ and orchestra premiere, he adapted it for clarinet and string quartet at the request of jazz man Eddie Daniels. During his 2000 visit to Philadelphia, I promised David I'd do my best to try to arrange a second performance of A Song After Sundown. It was a rash gesture, considering that I lacked a symphony orchestra to play it, a venue with a pipe organ for the solo part, and the missing parts for the musicians. But playing his brilliant film scores reminded me to keep telling people about it, always without success. Months later, I brought the score to Kyle Smith, the curator of the Fleischer Collection of Orchestral Music.
It has the signature Raxon involved harmonies, the convoluted and yet just luscious sounds that come from the orchestra and the organ. As soon as I saw it, I just loved the music and looking at the score. And I said to Tom, how can we get this played? I'd love to have it in the collection.
The possibility of a performance of A Song After Sundown edged closer a few months ago when the Kimmel Center's Mervon Mehta and I were talking about the organ festival.
Tom brought me the score, dropped it on my desk, and said, take a listen, see what you think. He said, there's a full orchestra version of this with organ. It's by a Philadelphia composer. It's only been played once in its life, and then the parts were lost. And it would be so cool if you could put this on the organ festival.
Mervon and Kyle Smith agreed to fund the project, though I was still missing one important piece, permission to perform it. But Raxon's daughter and son, Valentina and Alex, kindly and swiftly gave their blessing. The score went to a copyist in Vermont, the organ parts were sent to organist Michael Stairs, and suddenly all the pieces of the puzzle came together. A Song After Sundown is only a 10-minute work, but a beautifully written piece by a Philadelphian, perfect for this celebration of the new Kimmel Center organ. I wish David, one of the great composers from the golden age of film music, could hear his piece and know that I kept my promise. But knowing David Raxon, I'm sure he's listening.
Philadelphia Daily News arts writer and WRTI contributor Tom DiNardo. David Raxon's A Song After Sundown will be performed at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall tomorrow afternoon by organist Michael Stairs, with David Hayes conducting the Manus College of Music Orchestra. The Philadelphia neighborhoods of Old City and Society Hill that cradle Independence National Park are rich with history and stories of the nation's founding fathers. But at least one Philadelphian deserves credit as a founding mother, ready to sew on a button or throw together a new nation's flag. Now in our regular look inside the culture file section at gophilla.com, WRTI's Susan Lewis visits the Betsy Ross House on Arch Street in Philadelphia.
Everyone knows that Betsy Ross made the first American flag. Or did she? The story wasn't made public until almost 100 years after the fact, or fiction. In 1870, her grandson, William J. Canby, in a speech to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, repeated the family account that in 1776, George Washington and his flag committee supposedly came to Betsy to commission her to create the nation's flag. According to the legend, Betsy persuaded the committee to change the star from 6 points to 5, a shape she could make with one snip of her scissors. In 1873, Canby's story was published in Harper's Monthly. Laurie Dillard Reck is executive director of the Betsy Ross House, the restored historic house that Betsy rented from 1773 to 1786. Reck says it would have made sense for General Washington to come to Betsy Ross for flags, since she was an upholsterer and one with connections to the flag committee.
On that flag committee sat her uncle, actually uncle-in-law, and we believe that was probably the connection that was made. And so the legend came down that she became the creator of the first flag, although that flag does not exist. And so it has become problematic with historians to actually go back and say, did she indeed create the very first flag? But we have receipts very early on that say that she was commissioned to make these flags, and so it seems very likely that she did.
In the 1890s, artist Charles Weisgerber recreated the scene in a painting he called The Birth of Our Nation's Flag. The painting won a competition and toured the country. This picture, says Reck, became a way for Weisgerber to bring the story of Betsy Ross to life.
Using that image, he created certificates that he then sold for 10 cents in order to raise the funds to purchase the house so that he could turn it into a public historic home that people could visit and then learn more about Betsy Ross.
The house was turned into a museum in 1898, and in the 1930s was restored and dedicated to the city of Philadelphia. Historical architect Richardson Brunyard Oakey was commissioned to reconstruct the Ross residence, says collections manager Lisa Acker Mulder.
He studied the rooms. He looked at the floors to see where there was remnants of charring of the floor, and there he assumed there was probably a fireplace. He looked at where floorboards had been replaced and assumed maybe there was another staircase there. So he reconstructed a staircase. He tore down walls and discovered fireplaces.
Today, the house is furnished with many of Betsy Ross's own things, thanks to donations by descendants, as well as to some exciting discoveries in the house itself, says Mulder. One example is the large framed family tree that hangs on the wall in the first floor gallery.
We've been a museum since 1898, and various curators throughout the years had collected items, some of them undocumented, and this family tree happens to be one of those amazing pieces that was just located in the attic one day.
A self-guided tour through narrow passageways and tight circular staircases takes visitors through the house, to the parlor where the meeting with Washington and the Flag Committee may have taken place, and where today rests a print of Weisgerber's painting. There's a bedroom where Betsy likely retreated for the dangerous work on the flag of a new nation. We also visit the upholstery shop, where Laurie Reck says they did a lot more than simply stuff furniture.
They made the bed coverings, the hangings, the draperies, the curtains. They assembled Venetian blinds. They lined coffins. They made umbrellas, parasols. They also sold wallpaper. They would have sold it and then maybe even hung the wallpaper. So they really were kind of like a Home Depot. They did a lot to make your house look nicer.
Wandering around this house, we can learn about Betsy's life before and after the Historic Flag Commission. She was raised a Quaker, educated, and then apprenticed to an upholsterer. Her parents had high hopes for her as Betsy herself, or at least someone who looks a lot like her, explains.
Now, their intention was that this would leave me independent and I'd have all the time in the world to wait until the proper Quaker fellow came along to marry. Well, I didn't do that. I fell in love with the young man I was apprenticed with, a young man named John Ross, who was an Anglican, and after 9 years of study together side by side, we were so in love that we could not imagine for a moment separating. We thought it would be death to us both. And so what we did is we ran off and we eloped. My father was most upset. Well, he petitioned me to repent my horrendous sin, and when I would not and chose to worship at the Anglican Church instead, he had me read out of meeting, he disowned me, disinherited me, and I doubt he shall ever speak to me again.
Tragically, Betsy's marriage to John Ross lasted barely 3 years. In 1776, he was killed on militia duty. The next year, she married sailor Joseph Ashburn, and 5 years later was again widowed by the war. Her third marriage to John Claypool lasted 34 years until his death in 1817. Betsy and John Claypool moved from this house in 1786. As we leave, we can visit their graves. In this courtyard, interactive performances about life in 18th century America entertain visitors daily throughout the summer. Executive Director Laurie Reck says that the mission of the Betsy Ross House is to tell not only the legend of the flag, but the story of this remarkable woman's life.
She was this amazing business
person and also a single mom at many times during her life, and really had to persevere during the struggles of the War of Independence and make a living for herself and provide for her family. And there were so many women like that during the 18th century that very few people know very much about. And so she then becomes the model of women like that.
So did Betsy Ross create the very first American flag? It's possible, even probable, although without the actual banner as evidence, we may never know for sure. But does it really matter? The story is woven into the fabric of our national psyche. We are a nation of many stripes, and Betsy Ross is one of our stars.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on the Betsy Ross House is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. In 2004, Massachusetts became the first state to allow same-sex marriages, although not without some powerful opposition. That same year, President Bush proposed a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriages. While the debates and legal battles surrounding this and other gay and lesbian issues are far from being settled, there's certainly a great deal of dialogue on the subject these days. In contrast to decades past, when homosexuality was barely acknowledged publicly, there are now television shows and films that openly address homosexual themes, and several legislative and court battles have been waged and won, protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination. Against this backdrop of change in the United States, a new play of the Philadelphia Theatre Company, Some Men, takes a look at the evolution of gay relationships and same-sex marriage in America over the past 100 years. WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer has more on this provocative world premiere.
The story of Some Men begins in 2006 with a gay wedding. Although the two grooms are not seen on stage, Patrick and Eugene are getting married, and the attendees of the ceremony reveal their inner monologues.
I wonder if they know how profound those vows are. I didn't at their age. God bless them.
Take good care of each other.
What if they split? Who gets the house, the dogs?
Spoken like a true accountant.
Intellectually, emotionally, I understand why marriage is important.
From a civil rights point of view, I get it too. Anyone should be able to get married, as straight people have been doing it for centuries.
It's a business contract and a lousy one at that.
The storyline doesn't linger very long at Patrick and Eugene's wedding. The play quickly jumps back in time, visiting the lives of many different gay men. The show explores the challenges the men have faced in starting up and maintaining committed relationships. Philip Himberg, director of Some Men, conceived the idea of this expansive story. A few years ago, Himberg, who's the producing artistic director for the Sundance Institute theater program, was given a CD compilation called Club Verboten. The collection of songs purportedly tells the story of gay and lesbian people through pop music from the past 100 years. When Himberg listened to the CD, he quickly determined it could be the basis of a play that examines gay history.
I'm very interested in history because I think we're a culture that doesn't often appreciate our own history and doesn't remember it, and sometimes we get into trouble for it. I became aware that younger gay and lesbian people were asking me questions about the AIDS crisis as if it happened 50 years ago and not 10, 15 years ago. So I felt committed to looking at something that looked at evolving gay relationships over time.
Four-time Tony Award winner Terrence McNally wrote Some Men. Philip Himberg says he brought McNally on board for the project because he considers him one of the preeminent playwrights of our time.
I know that he has written plays that have gay characters, but look at the gay experience in a much broader way than just a kind of cloistered gay subculture. And so he seemed the natural person to tackle this material.
McNally's body of work includes a list of award-winning shows like Masterclass, Love, Valor, Compassion, Ragtime, and Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Writing for theater since the 1960s, McNally has created dramas, farces, and book musicals. With Some Men, John Glover believes McNally is breaking new ground in his career.
The play is like I don't think any other he's ever written.
Some Men is the third Terrence McNally play that John Glover has been in. The stage, film, and television actor notes the structure of the piece sets it apart from McNally's other works. As the action of the story moves along, it doesn't advance in any sort of chronological order. Instead, it's more like a collage or a scrapbook. It ricochets around in time to different people from present day to the 1970s to the 1930s to the 1960s. Glover explains the ambitious narrative demands a lot from the ensemble cast of the show.
We all play six or seven characters, which makes it quite unique for Terrence. He's exploring or pushing the ticket in our faces about same-sex marriage and commitment and fidelity. He's not making judgments about it. He's just questioning.
The questions and topics that some men raises are bound to make some people uncomfortable. With sexual frankness, strong language, and male nudity, it's not a show for the whole family. At the very least, though, it is thought-provoking theater, says John Glover.
I think this might be one of those walk-home plays after it's finished. When I was first in New York, when I would see a production that really hit me, I would find that I always had to walk home. You know, I couldn't get down on the subway right away. I needed just to think about it some more.
In addition to some deep thinking, audience members may very well also come away humming a few tunes. In part because of the songs on Club Verboten, the show incorporates a wide range of American pop music into the story. Philip Hinberg says this dynamic of the play reflects the importance of music in the gay community.
For a long period of time, particularly when gay people were closeted, music and art was one way for them to connect with emotions that were hard to connect with perhaps publicly. So that listening to a particular singer or a particular song was deeply, deeply significant in a way. You know, when you're not able to express who you are freely, music becomes a way in which you are able to express who you are, or listening to music or performing music.
Perhaps suspecting that people might be tempted to think of some men merely as a gay play, much like Brokeback Mountain was sometimes referred to as a gay cowboy movie, Philip Hinberg carefully points out that, of course, people from all walks of life find emotional release through music. Philadelphia Theater Company producing artistic director Sarah Goranczyk believes the play covers many universal themes. She says her catch-all phrase for the show has been,
"Some men is about all people." I think, even though it goes through the obvious front door of being about gay marriage and gay men at different periods of time in our history, I really feel it's about the human condition.
Nevertheless, what probably will be remembered most about the play are the gay themes and issues explored. Such subject matter is not particularly new content for theater stages, but in light of Terrence McNally's prominence and the continued heated national debate over same-sex marriage, it's worthwhile keeping an eye on the life of this new play and the response it generates.
Days may not be fair always, nights may not be there always. Not for just an hour, not for just a day, not for just a year, but always.
The opening song of Some Men, ending that story by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The new Terrence McNally play has its world premiere this Wednesday at the Philadelphia Theatre Company. It runs through June 11th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Debbie Fleischman, Jen Pear, Jim Jordan and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.